from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The death toll from the Nepal earthquake has climbed to almost 4,000. The country's military predicts that the death toll could climb to as high as 5,000. Thousands of Nepalis have begun fleeing the capital, Kathmandu, stricken with terror by 2 days of powerful aftershocks and looming shortages of food and water. CCTV's Ying Hong has more.
Search and rescue operations have been stepped up, but authorities have not been able to establish contact with some of the worst affected areas in the mountainous nation. An Interior Ministry official said the death toll could reach 5,000. Huge queues have formed at Kathmandu's airport, with the tourists and residents desperate to get a flight out. The Nepalese authorities are trying to cope with a shortage of drinking water, food and electricity, as well as the threat of disease. The government has appealed for international help. High in the Himalayas, hundreds of climbers have stayed at the base camp of Mount Chumulama, where a huge avalanche triggered by the earthquake killed 17 people. Rescue teams have used helicopters to airlift scores of people stranded at higher altitudes.
Operations to address the most urgent needs of people in the country are being scaled up by the UN and its partners. In the aftermath of the powerful earthquake that hit Nepal on Saturday, UN agencies have responded by deploying staff and sending emergency supplies. Stephanie Kutrix reports from the United Nations.
According to latest estimates and media reports, Saturday's quake killed at least 3,600 people and left thousands more injured. Many of those who survived lost their homes and are living in the open or in tent settlements. Staff from the UN's humanitarian office, OCHA, have been deployed to set up a center to coordinate search and rescue efforts. The World Health Organization is sending an emergency team to address the most urgent health issues and has started distributing surgical kits. The World Food Program is also on the ground, providing food items and trucks for distribution. On Monday, the UN Refugee Agency said it was sending 11,000 plastic sheets and 4,000 solar-powered lanterns. The plastic sheets will be used to construct or repair shelters, and the lamps will provide light at night. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, reported that nearly 1 million children require urgent humanitarian assistance. They are mobilizing staff and emergency supplies, focusing on water and sanitation, nutrition, education, and child protection. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
Tensions remain high in the occupied West Bank after Israeli forces shot and killed a Palestinian 2 days ago. In Gaza, residents are concerned that the escalating violence could extend to the besieged Palestinian enclave, setting off a spiral of attacks and counterattacks between Tel Aviv and local resistance forces. Noor Harazin from Tel Assur reports from Gaza.
Tension continue to rise in the towns and cities of the West Bank, especially in Hebron and also in the occupied Palestinian city of East Jerusalem. For the second day in a row, clashes started between Palestinian youth and also the Israeli forces after the Israeli forces killed a Palestinian man 2 days ago. The Palestinian people here in the Gaza Strip are fearing that this kind of tension will extend to the Gaza Strip, and the Palestinian resistance fighters in Gaza will fire rockets in response for the continuous Israeli attacks in the West Bank, dragging the Gaza Strip to a new Israeli operation.
Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe arrived in the U.S. Sunday for a week-long visit, showcasing the success of the alliance built from Tokyo's defeat in World War II, while promoting a political agenda based on stronger military and economic ties between the two nations. CCTV's Nathan King was in Washington and filed this report.
The last time the U.S. president and Japanese prime minister dined together, it was at a sushi restaurant in Tokyo.
That's some good sushi right there.
This week's events in Washington will be far more formal. It's the first official visit by a Japanese prime minister since 2006, and Shinzo Abe will become the first Japanese leader to address a joint session of the U.S. Congress. Behind the pomp and ceremony, this visit also seeks to strengthen the alliance. The two powers will update their defense guidelines for the first time in two decades. Expect more support from Washington for Japan's controversial new security legislation, which seeks an expanded regional role for Japanese forces.
But any movement of any kind in the direction of a more advanced and more capable Japanese military presence internationally, a peaceful one, but nevertheless a military presence, that will be welcomed by the United States and the Obama administration.
Much of the new relationship will be framed around the threat posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. China thinks the new phase in the alliance could partly be aimed at Beijing, especially as the U.S. says its security guarantees with Japan extend to the Dwaeyu Islands, which the Japanese call Senkaku. On trade, Abe will push the U.S. Congress to get President Obama the ability to finalize the negotiations on the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Area and allow a yes or no vote with no amendments. While the meetings will focus on the future, Japan's past will also play a role. This year marks the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. Visits by Abe and his political allies to the controversial Yasukuni Shrine in Tokyo, which commemorates Japanese war dead, including more than 1,000 war criminals, have rankled many nations, including U.S. ally South Korea. Japan has its historical problems with the U.S. too. 70 years ago, atom bombs were dropped by U.S. forces on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. But after the occupation, there was an alliance that lasted for the 20th century and now is being updated for the 21st. Nathan King, CCTV, Washington.
Saudi Arabia pushed ahead with its military offensive against Yemen over the weekend. The civilian death toll continues to rise. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
The latest attacks have targeted the districts of Malahid, Manzala, and Safra in the northern Saada province and a district in Abyan governorate. Both Saudi artillery and warplanes were involved in attacks that reportedly left a number of Yemeni soldiers and Houthi fighters dead. Nearly 3,000 people, mostly civilians, have been killed since Riyadh began pounding Yemen on March the 26th. The country's infrastructure and residential areas have been hit hard. Meanwhile, the camp of the fugitive former president has rejected a call for peace talks despite growing civilian casualties. Well, to get the latest on that situation in Yemen, we're now joined by Mohammed Al-Attar, Press TV's correspondent from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Mohammed, of course, the bodies are piling up and the Saudi airstrikes continue.
Yes, with the continuation of the Saudi airstrikes, there are always civilian people who are falling victims of such a war, which has been described by human rights activists as a genocidal war that doesn't only target a specific group, but it's targeting the whole country. It's targeting the industrial infrastructure as well as also the food supply. So the situation is continuing to escalate and deteriorate with the continued air and sea embargo in Yemen, which has prevented the supply and the provision of food and basic accommodation. This kind of war has also impacted the Yemeni situation, especially the humanitarian situation.
Sitara Jaheen with the International Red Cross Near and Middle East told RT's Rory Suchet that the fighting is preventing aid workers from helping to alleviate the humanitarian crisis there.
Right now, today, in Yemen, we have not even been able to carry out an investigation at our own level because the security situation does not allow our teams to move around safely. Our convoys, aid convoys, were stopped 3 times in different locations by the parties to the conflict in Yemen. We are not a country, so we are not a national government, so that's why we cannot really go to the ICC like the governments can do. But it's really up to the governments if they want to pursue it in that sense. Our teams go to those places where war and where heavy fighting has been taking place, and we document the cases ourselves, and we hold these discussions strictly bilaterally with the concerned parties.
Another round of talks over the crisis in Syria. The UN Security Council met and discussed ways back to the table to try to forge a settlement to the brutal violence that has plagued the country for the past 4 years. This was the Security Council president for April, Dina Kawar, who was also the permanent representative of Jordan to the UN, speaking with journalists following the council consultations on the situation in Syria this past Friday.
The UN Security Council members heard a briefing from the Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, on his efforts to facilitate reaching a political solution for the conflict in Syria. The envoy addressed the immeasurable suffering of the Syrian people, which requires, as he mentioned, to try again some negotiations and refocus negotiations to overcome differences and narrow the gap towards a political solution on the basis of the Geneva Communique, the framework which has international consensus. The envoy mentioned particularly what he will do next month in Geneva in terms of holding structured, consultative, separate meetings with the Syrian parties, representatives of the civil society, and regional and international actors. He mentions that he will provide his assessment to the Secretary General and will keep the Security Council informed. I would like to say that the Security Council members, all of them, expressed their support for the envoy's efforts and reiterated their support for the political solution based on the Geneva Communique and called on parties to participate effectively. And we all asked the envoy to be briefed, to brief us after his consultations in Geneva.
Stefan de Mistura, special envoy of the Secretary General for Syria, also spoke with journalists following the closed-door council session Friday. He stressed that he would be inviting Iran to the table in any negotiations over the conflict in Syria, and that the so-called Islamic State, whom he called terrorists, would not. As we reported Friday, another major step was announced in the continuing development of ties between Russia and Latin America, with Argentina and the Russian Federation announcing the signing of a number of major agreements expanding their military and technological ties. We discussed that and more in our weekly segment with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, which began with a discussion of that historic visit by Argentina's President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner with Russia's President Vladimir Putin in Moscow.
I saw some photographs of them, and honestly, if those two got married, would that be the ultimate power couple?
Well, yeah.
I mean, they're both available, I believe, so.
That's an interesting take on it, on that visit, yeah. Apart from that, and one of the things I've been talking about with colleagues down here is what is the United States response going to be to the fallout from the Panama summit? Mm. And it's as if, you know, right on cue you then have President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner visiting Moscow.
Yeah, making all kinds of deals too.
So and another thing that's happened, just as a kind of footnote, because obviously Cristina's visit to the Russian Federation is much more important, but just as a footnote to that, yesterday, I don't know if you saw on Telesur, and I was very surprised because it hasn't been announced here in Nicaragua yet, but Telesur reported that the head of the Sandinista parliamentary bloc here in Nicaragua has confirmed that President Daniel Ortega has sent some legislation to the National Assembly requesting that the National Assembly authorize the government to sign an agreement with the Russian Federation about the installation of satellites for climate prediction and control, not control, but prediction and prevention, so that the Nicaraguan government is better able to take care of its population in the event of events like El Nino, the climate phenomenon that tends to cause severe drought, and its reverse, La Niña, which tends to cause excessive rains. Mm-hmm. That's my take on that. And it was just interesting, I thought, that at the same time that the president of Argentina is visiting the Russian Federation, Nicaragua should announce a potential agreement with the Russian Federation, for support from satellites to deal with climate change.
You know, there's some spokes to that, too, if you think about it, because if you look at the project that Nicaragua was embarking upon, the major project, which is the canal, and that is essentially, as far as foreign powers go, a Chinese project. Having advanced forecasting capability on such a massive construction project is, of course, not only useful, but in this day and age, probably an assumed precondition. And so I'm wondering, maybe the Chinese are helping to fund the Russian development of that somehow, because they should if they're not. It's certainly in their interest, and they're going to be the largest beneficiary of it in the short term.
Yeah, and I suspect that there's probably behind-the-scenes agreements between not just China and Nicaragua, but Russia, and obviously. There is that kind of geostrategic aspect, if you like, but it's one that the Nicaraguan government and its partners tend to play down.
Right.
And there is a genuine concern, not just in Nicaragua, but also in the region, about the effects of climate change. And I don't know, am I mistaken in thinking that President Obama recently made some declarations in relation to criticizing people who deny climate change?
Yeah, I mean, they weren't the strongest fact-laden challenges, but yeah, it was an indication, like a popular culture style indication, that you people are denying science and you need to get your head out of the sand. Yes, he did.
So yeah, and that's interesting too, because, and it's as if there's kind of a discomposition in kind of positions, and that there moving to the wider theme of, you know, what is going to be the U.S. response, the United States government response to the fallout from the Panama summit, where the United States and Canada pretty much faced a more or less united bloc of Caribbean and Latin American countries,
right,
saying, look, we're not going to accept the old status quo, and you, the United States, and your allies have to accept that here in Latin America and the Caribbean, we're doing things somewhat differently than we've done in the past, and we're not going to let you stop us doing it.
Well, what really angered the Americans and the Canadians, however, was when they then said, and by the way, when this is over, big party at UNASUR headquarters in Quito, you're not invited, and you're not invited.
So that's a very clear statement, isn't it, in which international relations policy by the overwhelming majority, if not all, the Latin American and Caribbean countries is going. And that, so, you know, talking about, you know, what's happening after Panama, and one of the things that has cropped up in discussions with people here is that events are happening at different speeds. And so things happening in the political area move at different speeds. Things happening in the economic area move at different speeds. Things happening in development cooperation, different things are happening at different speeds, and it's really difficult to get a coherent take. It's almost impossible to take a snapshot and say this is what's happening.
Mm. Yeah, you've got all this material confirmation of the theory of the law of unequal development. If you look at the meeting that's taking place, or I think it closes today, the Asian African Summit, for example. And some of the pronouncements about what's going to happen this year within the African Union. So much of the influence of what has already developed in Latin America and the Caribbean upon both the local actors in Africa, for example, and the role that I heard President Mugabe pitch to the Asians and really China, that is the same project that's been pursued in Latin America for, you know, since 1998.
Yeah. Yeah, and that kind of South-South cooperation is likely to become more and more obvious and self-evident as the years go by, and because it's very, very clear that countries in Africa, and South Africa is the most obvious example, but Angola, Mozambique, certainly Zimbabwe, very much so, are looking at what's happening in Latin America and thinking, well, we could do that too. And so the visit by Cristina Kirchner to, the visit by Argentine President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner to the Russian Federation takes place in that context. And as you pointed out right at the beginning, I mean, the Russian Federation and Argentina signed something, I think it's a total of something like 20 agreements. But the most important thing, perhaps the most important thing, obviously it depends on your point of view, but the most important thing that I got from Cristina's comments following her meetings with President Vladimir Putin and his colleagues is that they've decided that they're going to engage in trade in their own currencies.
Yes, very significant.
So, and what that means is that the events in the legal system and in the court system in New York, where you have Judge Thomas Griesa emitting these megalomaniac rulings from a district court in New York, yep, telling Argentina what to do, they become more and more irrelevant. I mean, of course, they have their effect, but how can one draw a comparison between the influence of somebody like Judge Thomas Griesa and the president of the Russian Federation and the president of Argentina? And it's completely crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's out of scale for sure. And, you know, it's interesting that they announced that they were going to be using their own currencies, because that is almost becoming, and this is really an occurrence over the last year in terms of its acceleration, but it's almost becoming a standard in South-South BRICS deals. This is not the first, and it's not even the second this year that were announced. Russia and China are doing a lot of that now, and China is doing it with other countries. Iran and Russia are doing it as well.
Yeah, Argentina's already been engaged in an agreement along those lines with China, and I think they agreed that something like 2 years ago with China. So that's, it's another development in the things that we've been talking about for a long, long time now, Don. And the way that international economic and trade arrangements are being rearranged so as not to permit the United States in particular, but the United States and its European allies, for example, and perhaps Japan to some extent, to dominate the kinds of structures that exist to facilitate international trade and international finance. And you probably know a bit more about this than I do, but I remember about a week, 2 weeks ago, there were a lot of articles appearing in the international media about the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank.
Right.
And the way in which various European countries that are definitely United States allies were signing up to participate in that initiative. And there's a lot of comment to the effect that, oh dear, look at all these European allies bailing out and leaving the United States in the lurch, because the United States didn't want them to sign up to that agreement. And I think a lot of that was overstated, in my opinion, because...
Right, the size of it is, it's not on a scale with that stuff yet. But I think the creation of it is its own significance, not that it's going to capture the lion's share any time soon. But you know what? Robert Mugabe, President of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe invoked exactly the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank as a model for the relations that he wants to establish with Asia, while in the context of him asking Asia to help as a partner develop infrastructure in Africa.
And of course, it's not so much the immediate material effect that the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank is likely to have on the world economy, as so much as it institutes a different way of dealing with development finance that is likely to crowd out, I mean, to use that term, the institutions that were set up in 1945, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And you can see how, you know, you can see the appeal of that, because one just has to look at what's happening with Greece and the way the IMF and the World Bank, in particular the IMF, have been completely counterproductive in the way they've dealt with that situation, and in together with the European Central Bank and the European structures generally, the European Commission, the European Council. And so the something that's set up in a way that treats other countries as equals and not as kind of scapegoats for the financial system's own failures, which is what's happened in the case of Greece. I mean, something like the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank is very different in that sense, and is likely to have a medium term, may not have a short term impact, but it'll certainly have a medium and long term impact. And the same may well be true of the Bank of the South that's supposed to start operation next month.
You know, when people talk about the economic development and deals particularly, it's like any other transaction. I mean, there is the transaction itself, and then there are the material components of the transaction that are the reality of it. This, we're taking these things and assembling them this way and applying it to this or that problem. And all you have to do is look at the outcomes after adopting or following this model or that model, because the neoliberal model leaves in its wake Greece, debt, Argentina, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, etc. And the cooperative model, what they're starting to call the win-win model, but essentially the model that was developed in Latin America, leaves behind an eradication of extreme poverty, severe mitigation of poverty, infrastructure, development, all these constructive things. At the end of the day, you end up with schools and hospitals and power plants instead of debt. It's got to be more attractive to places that need those things.
Yeah, and I think in every way, that model that's been developed in Latin America is based on solidarity and a kind of complementary integration of different countries' economies. The U.S. government's going to continue its attacks, its economic and low-intensity warfare attacks, financing terrorism in Venezuela, for example, generally trying to destabilize countries who refuse to go along with U.S. policy in the region, like Ecuador, like Bolivia, like Cuba, although there's this much heralded opening with Cuba. And what the United States is likely to do in tandem with that continuing campaign of destabilization here in Latin America is to try and co-opt countries like, continue to try and co-opt countries like Chile, Mexico, Colombia, to participate in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, integrating in a way that destroys the nation state. Because historically, since the development of capitalism, what's protected, insofar as it has been able to protect people, protected people from the worst depredations of corporate consumer capitalism has been regulation by individual nation states.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.